The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Good evening, everybody. This is Greg Fries on behalf of Bill Toon and Rob Terrio for the EMS Educast. I got to tell you guys, I admit it, I am supremely distracted tonight. I'm only, 2 days away from what I call the most optimistic day of the year, and that's the day before deer camp. That's when in Wisconsin we go out to our cabins in the woods in the country, and then on Saturday morning is the opening of the gun deer season. So by Friday night, optimism levels are off the chart as we all gather around at the cabin to plot our hunting strategies and, you know, predict how we're going to have a whole bunch of deer early Saturday morning. Because optimism runs supreme on Friday evening. So my optimism meter is already well above normal, Rob, and it's only getting higher with each minute that goes by as I look forward to deer hunting in a couple days.
I'm afraid of stray bullets, so good for you.
Yeah, well, that's a reasonable fear to have. We take what I like to think is great precautions at our hunting camp, I guess that's a concern, but boy, that stray bullets could be a hazard anywhere.
I love that story from EMS-1 that came up recently where the guy was trying to shoot a raccoon and sneezed and shot himself.
Ooh, ouch. Ouch. Yeah.
Only paramedics can laugh at that.
Yeah. Yeah. I once was at work. This was in the ER days, and some guy came running through the door. My friend, he's been shot. And I'm like, well, where's your friend? He's walking in from the parking lot. Like, where'd he get shot? He shot himself in the foot. And I'm like, all right. This maybe isn't as bad as we might have thought based on your drama. Bill, do you have anything that leads up to the most optimistic day of the year in your hobbies?
Absolutely. And that is the Army-Navy game.
Oh.
That's where I build up to mine is the Army-Navy game and stuff. So, but Greg, I have a real question for you. Don't you think that the deer are more in danger from automobiles than they are really from hunters?
Well, statistically, more deer are killed with guns and bows and arrows in Wisconsin than they are by cars. But you're correct that last I saw, upwards of 50 to 60,000 deer per year are killed on the roadways of Wisconsin, leading to great vehicle damage, not to mention oftentimes lethal damage to the deer, and many injuries and sometimes even fatalities, especially motorcycle riders that might strike a deer. So it is a very real risk. I've actually known several companions on bicycles that have hit deer while biking, and that also is more thrill than either party bargained for.
Yeah, and I was trying to find it here for you, but I remember one year that they were saying that in Italy, hunting season is one of the most dangerous times in the country in Italy, and it's not due to the animals that are killed, it's the number of hunters that get off.
Huh. Well, and Wisconsin, we have a few hunting fatalities every year, unfortunately, and it's oftentimes just carelessness, people not knowing their target and beyond, and then shooting either before or after daylight, or not complying with the blaze orange tire regulations that we have here in Wisconsin.
Or taking the sport to a new and disturbed level.
Yes. It's unfortunately, it was many years past when we had that incident here. But before we get too far into the gloom and doom, we do have a guest on the line. Bobby Marico, welcome to the EMS Educast.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. It was quite a riveting story I heard going back and forth. I didn't know whether I should be amused or afraid.
Well,
I'd be afraid.
I could fill this hour with tales either true or loosely based on the truth from the hunts of the past, but probably we'd have a lot of listeners that might tune out for that. But if anybody wants at the end, I would be happy to share more stories.
Well, it makes me happy that I'm firmly planted here in California.
Okay. Well, and so you're in California. We're scattered among many time zones. You and I met at EMS World Expo when I walked by your booth, and I saw all sorts of stuff going on with wounds and simulated injuries, and I thought, wow, we got to know more about this. So tell us about who you are, what it is that you do, your training, your education, your involvement in healthcare. Paint a detailed picture for us.
Okay, my name is Bobby Marica, as you know, and I am the author of my most recent book, Medical Moulage, How to Make Your Simulations Come Alive, and I'm the owner of Moulage Concepts, which is a cutting-edge company that assists military, veterinary, EMS responder, nursing hospitals, in addition to nursing schools and med schools, in creating realistic training that brings along the storyline that works with the technology. I got into the profession quite by accident. I love my story and how I actually got here. Long ago, before anyone was actually putting anything on simulators, but the technology was there, I kept hearing from our nursing our nursing students and our EMS responders, you know, this doesn't feel real, because in the field, in the clinical setting, I'd see this and I'd feel that and I'd hear this and I'd even smell that. And I thought, that's exactly correct. So I started doing some research on what could go onto a simulator, and more importantly, what could come back off. And from there, I started studying wound characteristics and military videos, things like that, so that I could create training wounds. And what I do is I provide the training. I actually come in and show you how to make them yourself so that it's cost-effective for the different entities that bring me forth. And so that they can be debrided, they can be sutured, they have odors that come along to them. And basically what it does is it strengthens that storyline in the scenario in the training that people bring forth. So, like I said, it's been sort of an accidental career, but word got out, and then I was contacted by a publisher over on the East Coast who had heard about what I was doing and asked if I'd be willing to write a book. And that's been 3 books since then. And, you know, from that bore a whole new career to begin, but also a whole new industry that started Medical Moulage.
So what were you doing, like, before you got, you know, that, I guess, what were you doing that you were in the situation where, you know, EMTs and nursing students and such were telling you that they were looking for more realism in the wounds?
You know, I was starting up simulation centers. That was back when, you know, so many years ago when everybody was giving, or they weren't giving, the grant funded, was providing simulators for the nursing centers, and people were building up their programs. So I started out my career as a simulation, was now known as a specialist at the time. It was a simulation technologist. And then from there, I moved up into a simulation coordinator position where I had the privilege of starting a lab from the ground up, actually being in part of the process of building the lab to my specifications along with the team and developing the program. So, you know, and that sort of brought me here. And so now after that, I actually was given the contract for the Bureau of Public Health and Emergency for the state of Arizona. And that really sort of launched me out for the rest of the world.
When you started with the Moulage, was that part of a school that you worked with?
Yes, I'm sorry. It was for the California State University system.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I'm impressed they had someone dedicated to Moulage. That's pretty amazing.
Well, you know, they had someone actually dedicated to developing the program. They did not consider the moulage aspect of it. It was something that I had brought to the table simply to provide that realism to share with the students so that they would be engaged. You know, that was that time that you really need. You couldn't tell what people really knew, what their ability was to assess completely and with their injury recognition and the training and retention. We didn't really know what that was until we provided a full case scenario, because it was so easy to say, well, of course I knew that, and had it been more real, I could have shown you that. So that became my number one goal, is to provide such realism that then it created a scenario moving forward that we really could tell what people, where their thinking was and where their training was, so that, you know, primarily moving forward, we knew how to train them better.
Is your background in healthcare, or?
I was pretty much raised in a hospital. I went to work at a hospital when I was about 18 years old, and so I was raised in the hospital industry while I put myself through school for, believe it or not, accounting. I took the prerequisites to get into the nursing program primarily because blood and guts, I just couldn't quite take it. And I thought, accounting, that's a nice, clean career.
Right. Interesting how you got back into simulating it, though.
Yeah, blood and guts simulation.
Yes, and you know, and I really do get into it. It's like my wounds are truly, they're interactive. So they're three-dimensional wounds, and that you can debride, you can drain, you can suture them, you can decon them, triage. If you can think it, we can do it, and we even provide the odors that go along with it, because, again, we're all about creating that realistic training scenario.
So, yeah, I made a note here about smell. And so what kind of odors are you trying to simulate, and then maybe how do you, so first of all, I guess I can imagine lots of bad smells, but what are some common smells that are part of simulation?
Well, you know, as you're aware, most infectious processes have a really strong odor.
Yeah.
You can smell infection. There's also, you know, the burning flesh or the burning hair that will come in with your burn triage scenes. Blood is very specific in its odor, in its hemorrhaging. I get a lot of calls for C. diff. Everyone wants to recreate that one. And just as a side note, not that this is the most normal thing, but maybe I'll fit in better with you guys if I tell you my story. I actually spent the week of my birthday in a hospital smelling petri dishes of C. diff so I could create that odorous recipe exactly as it should be. Retrospectively, it wasn't that great of an idea, and I'm pretty sure it probably colonized up in my nose after that. But
yeah, I was just going to suggest nasal colonization.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, there's got to be a better way for a girl to spend her birthday week.
Yeah, I suppose. So
how does one get access to C. diff petri dishes and actually get permission to sniff them? That's what puzzles me.
And maybe I shouldn't have actually have shared that. You know, I had to pull a few strings.
Oh.
Yeah.
But, you know, once you have a few books under your name and you're sort of become the expert in that area, doors open a little easier. I imagine it had it just been Bobby America wanting to walk in and smell petri dishes, I might have been turned away with a smile, and perhaps security would have been called.
Yeah. So you smell something, like you experience it personally, and then what do you start mixing up to smell like infection? Like what are some of the ingredients that go into the smell of an infected wound?
Well, really quick, easy type of wound would be, let's go with the dehiscence type of wound, okay? So a surgical dehiscence that's clearly has busted open. And so one of the quickest, easiest wounds or drainage to come off that, you know, I can go into great detail about how you could make the drainage to come off it, but one of the best looking drainages that you are ever going to find is cream of mushroom soup, straight from the can.
Okay.
You'll never look at food the same way again. Now, and if I'm really looking to add odor to that, then what I would do is I might mix in a little bit of Limburger cheese. I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of smelling Limburger cheese.
I'll remind you that I'm in Wisconsin. Not only have I smelled it, but I've eaten it.
Okay.
By choice.
It's pretty specific.
Yeah.
Yes, it is a pretty specific smell. So if you, you know, you add it into your wound and you pack it in, so when someone goes to do a dressing change, for instance, or, you know, a debridement, then they really get that entire sensory feel. You know, as soon as they take that bandage off, they'd visually see it. They'd, you know, they could smell it. It creates that buy-in that we're looking for.
Huh. Do you all have a good vomit recipe?
Oh, yes. You know, we often create our vomit. Now, we work both on simulators as well as live participants.
Okay.
So, you know, we don't worry so much about staining our live participants as much as we worry, which isn't necessarily that nice, as much as we worry about our $300,000 simulators.
Right.
Because they'll remember you if you do. So, often when I'm brought in for a scenario, they'll ask me, you know, I always know when my patients are coming in, and they don't think they want vomit until I'm there about 15 minutes. And then people get very excited, realizing, oh, these blisters, you really can rupture them if they're handled aggressively. And so your scenarios tend to grow. So I often advise people, keep a little bit of cat food in a plastic bag in your lodge kit. You know, you can add water to it, and it'll puff right up, and you can smush it into the bag for any type of reason, you know, and use that as a vomitous type of mixture. But if I was actually going to make it according to my book recipe, it's generally a combination of I use some oatmeal, I toss in a little bit of chopped up cat food with it, because it depends on how long ago I want to simulate my storyline. Like, was this breakfast, and is it now 9 o'clock in the morning, or is this breakfast, and it's now 4:30 in the morning?
Now,
or, excuse me, 4:30 in the afternoon.
Can this cat food be fresh, or does it have to be rotting?
Well, you know, it's usually dry. If it's fresh, you know, it'll certainly show digested food, but everyone tells a story. So if you want to show, like, someone has an ileus, then, of course, that would be undigested food. So as opposed to, you know, your victims are going to vomit if they do too much smoke inhalation or they have a cardiac event, things like that. So that can be more processed food. But from my book, I think the actual recipe states a little bit of oatmeal, a little bit of cat food.
Did you say dry cat food or canned cat food?
Dry cat food.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, dry cat food. I might mix in some, you know, depending on what it is I want to use. A lot of my wounds are designed to be used long term, from a cost advantage point of view. Since most simulation centers don't start out with a lot of money, I often create scenarios that show you how to reuse your wounds over and over again, how to store them, how to refreshen them back up, because what people generally don't have is time and money. So if it takes you longer than to put together a scenario than 5 minutes, and it costs you more than just probably a few pennies, you're not going to do it.
Huh. Right, good point.
I've learned from Rob. A Canadian taught me a great vomit recipe, and it was canned green beans, orange juice, and Parmesan cheese, grated Parmesan cheese. And it had the, what I would often do is, you know, sort of give it a cup to the patient, and they would actually hold some in their mouth because it was generally stuff not totally appealing, but edible. Versus, I suppose, cat food. But then, so they would kind of chew it a bit before the sort of dramatic moment as to which they were to vomit it out. But that, you know, that the strong, like, connection, the smell, the mix of smells, I think is part of a good vomit recipe. Certainly oatmeal is a tried and true standby as well, because it can take so many different sort of textures.
Well, and, you know, even vomit will tell so much of a story. You know, is there medication in this vomit from my patient? Is this vomit due to smoke inhalation or a cardiac event? Is there blood in it? And what, you know, or is that just somebody's red sucker that they were sucking on a little bit earlier? Is this bile? You know, even vomit can take you down so many different paths to lead a story through. And it's a very cheap mixture to put together.
Yeah.
When I create my scenarios, generally what I do is I actually make my vomit, hand it out in little baggies to people. Really? And then generally I tell them just to put a little bit of water in their mouth and expel the vomit when you see your responder coming. And as they get a little bit closer to you, start retching and actually spit out the water, they're not going to really notice what's coming from your mouth isn't what else is sitting all over your shirt and on the floor.
Hmm. Bill, you were about to jump in with something.
Yes, so huh? you're telling me it's not appropriate to save the vomit that you scrape up off the floor of the ambulance and reuse that at a later time?
Not appropriate,
you know,
Bill.
My pee later vomit, just so you know, is reusable.
Yeah.
Listen, I see nothing wrong with the stuff on the floor.
Except there was an incident that did, I can't remember which of the trade journals covered it, online sites about blood being used, real human blood being used that was obtained from a blood bank, and that led to someone at least getting disciplined, if I read correctly.
I would say so.
You know, occasionally I come across that somebody will send me an email or they'll very excitedly come and talk to me about the fact that they're using pig's blood and they've gone to the butcher and they've picked up all these bones. And I usually, you know, advocate that they create it from products that isn't going to get them in trouble with the FDA. That, you know, in the storyline, we can recreate realism in so many different ways without actually crossing that line and putting anyone in any kind of danger. You know, those actual blood products and even clean blood products, you know, there's certain storage regulations that come in. I tell people, I don't care how long you've boiled your chicken bones, let's just fake it and make some.
That's hazardous waste. That's just
Salmonella, yeah. Trichinosis, are a couple that come to mind. E. coli.
You know, things have gotten way. Is it too much sophistication? Come on, when I got into this, if you didn't get off that call absolutely covered in blood and vomit, you weren't taking care of people. Now remember, this was before we were concerned about HIV.
We just weren't
too smart.
And you had to sustain a Sharpe's injury from an IV needle in the bench seat as well.
You guys, old-timers.
I didn't say you had to get that from the bench seat or anything, but I can truly tell you that I clearly remember getting very covered, and it was just the great sign that you were truly involved in the call. But things have changed.
I remember when we used to try to catch vomit with K basins. How archaic was that in a moving ambulance? Thank goodness for those one-way bags now.
So, you know, Bobby, in the sort of like you talked about, like, you know, that the moulage becomes part of the case. So when you're planning a simulation or a scenario, at what point does it make sense to start planning, you know, what the wounds are going to be and what they're going to look like, you know, sort of lay out what a good simulation process, including wound moulage, would look like?
Well, you always want to start with the end in mind, as you do when you create your scenario. What do you want them to pull from it? Is it just a basic head-to-toe assessment? Well, then, you know, a simple tattoo would be significant on, you know, that you could mark down, or a little bit of a skin deterioration, reddening on the heel of a victim or your patient. You know, you don't have to knock anyone over the head with your moulage when your simple, you know, outcome isn't necessary for it. But if moulage can drive your story and make it stronger, you know, you should always be doing so. And so when you drive your stories using moulage, for instance, you can think in terms of, okay, so it's a competency, for instance, of a sterile dressing change. Now, I had to learn this the hard way, which was simply when I first learned how to do my wound dehiscence with the thick, purulent, odorous drainage, I couldn't wait to use it. So I did it on a second semester competency for a wound dressing change. Now, it was a great story, and retrospectively, it didn't need, you know, it needed to be a nice, clean, intact wound that served the purpose, because if you're doing a competency with a wound dressage, drainage or dressing change, you know, they should see something. I think dressing changes on top of nothing is just such a waste of resources, but it should be clean, it should be tight. I completely shut down that entire competency because every time a student opened up that dressing, they were totally taken aback by this complex wound that had dehisced and now had this odorous drainage coming from it.
Nice.
Yes.
That's awesome.
It was really kind of a proud moment, but it was also this really great learning moment. And so it changed forever how I needed to move forward when I created my scenarios. So when I receive my scenarios from whoever sends them to me, I always ask them, and I always ask, you know, okay, so this is a cardiac victim, so do you want them to vomit? Do you want them to have, you know, diaphoresis? Do you want them to have, you know, the whole list of different symptoms that we could create? And it doesn't have to be really complex. Sometimes the simplest ones are the most, you know, as you know, closed head injuries. That's just a little bit of bruising, maybe, you know, behind the neck, but yet that is such a serious type of injury that most people miss. And so, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I cut in on you there. Finish, and then let me sneak in.
Okay. So, you know, and when we create wounds, I teach it in my courses that every wound needs to be specific to the representation of time. A lot of times I go into case scenarios and I find wounds that are just inappropriate to your case setting. You know, we see bruises that are black and blue and purple on a scenario that the incident supposedly took place a half an hour ago. Their wounds are not appropriate to what our wound outcome is. And that's the entire point of training is that people catch, you know, your responders catch those subtleties of those wounds moving forward. What is their training set at so that we can better provide them training in the future?
That's great.
Good. Bill, go ahead first and then Rob.
So I'm going to ask the two what I think are very common type things. How do you make someone look pale but without making them look like a clown? And then how do you get them to be sweaty with where the water will, where it will maintain a little bit, you know, and not dry up so quickly? Those are two very simple things that if people could do those in simplistic ways, they would go a long way in helping the scenarios.
You know, and those are really common errors that I tend to find. So thank you for bringing them up. You know, what most people do when you're creating pallor, they make everyone look completely white. And pallor is actually about modeling. So to make somebody look pale but not like a clown, as you had stated, their own natural skin also needs to shine through. So when you're applying the makeup, you actually use what's called a blotting technique. Most people have a very heavy hand when they're creating their wounds, and so it's just this really defined shade of white. And if you do a modeling, which is more of it's kind of a blotting technique, and so your hand would go up and down using whatever tool, and you're going to want to use a lighter tool, such as a blush brush on your cream-based makeup. And what you do is you blot the color over the entire skin, and just the act of using the blotting technique with the blush brush doesn't allow you to put on the amount of makeup that most people want to do using a swiping technique and maybe a heavier application product such as a makeup sponge. So that's actually the piece that you see that is too much color. So am I being clear on what the blotting, how that would look visually to you?
I'm still struggling trying to say blush brush.
Make a blush brush, like what a woman would put her blush on.
Right.
I'm just being silly about blush brush.
And back to the other part of Bill's question is, how do you replicate the sweating and keep them wet or clammy looking?
Okay, so that is what we like to use is a glycerin. Most people can get their hands on glycerin, and there's a little caveat to using glycerin, which I'll share with you in a moment. The glycerin sweat mixture is usually a 5-to-1 ratio of water to the glycerin. So it's going to be 5 parts water to 1 part glycerin. You put it in a spray bottle and you give it a really good shake. Now, if you put your makeup on, your cream makeup on first, and you spritz the sweat mixture or the diaphoresis mixture that you've just made in the bottle onto the skin, it'll sit on top of the skin and it'll roll down, but the glycerin will keep it up on top of the skin. Now, just as an FYI, glycerin can burn your eyes when it goes in. So I never spray it above the eyebrows. some people go and they put the hat back on, or they rub on their face, and that brings it down on the eyes. You always want to keep ensure that your victims are, you know, you maintain their well-being at all time. So across their forehead, I might use a clear lip gloss that I just blot on.
Okay. Where do you find glycerin?
Glycerin is available through my website. You can also find it at some pharmacies.
A good segue there, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Forget the pharmacies, people. Just get it at Bobby's website.
Yes. Yes.
All other glycerin is totally suboptimal, low-quality stuff.
It is. If you want great sweat, you have to go to my website.
Right. Right. Excellent. Whoops. Feces.
Oh, feces. Yes. Again, tells quite a story. If you ever look through my book, there is probably 30 pages. By the way, I don't know if you've seen my book. It's a 5-pound baby. It has over 1,800 pictures in it. And I kid you not, really is 5 pounds. You could swing it around the room and kill somebody.
I'd be afraid to open it. It might smell or something.
It does not smell. It's actually quite lovely. Oh, okay. We brought in a food photographer to take all the pictures. We took 10,000 pictures for the book. And I bet
that food photographer really enjoyed that.
There are literally 50 pictures, over 50 pictures of feces types of wounds, because again, you know, bodily processes work together to tell a story. And moulage is designed to tell the story without the written words. So if your moulage doesn't support your scenario, then I usually tell people, let's look harder at the moulage.
Okay.
So the feces recipes, you know, there's the healthy feces, there's the white feces, there's the yellow feces, the green, you know, the multiple colors, and you know, then there's the species or the feces that do specific things.
Wait a minute. There's feces that does things? Now you're scaring me. This is worse than the hunting stories.
Well, you know, is it a colonoscopy? Is that what is it? What are we looking for? What kind of feces are we looking to drive our story?
So
you know, what feces, is it that...
Hmm? Feces from a colonoscopy look different from the stuff that floats in the toilet, presumably. Oh, yes.
So, yes, and we don't need. I'm assuming you know that, but we don't have to go into any further detail about it. Yes, and it's going to be. You know, are we involved in a disease process? What brought that person here? Is this a normal, healthy exam, or is this some? Are these other symptoms? Is this, you know, going to be related to an ulcer? Things like that.
This is a disturbing conversation, but it has me wondering if you can replicate fecal disimpaction on a mannequin and how fun that would be.
I could. I have. It is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Moving on to another subject matter.
Bill, I thought your question was really good about the pallor and then the diaphoresis. What's another sort of like common thing that people try to simulate that they probably are getting wrong, Bobby, that there's an easy solution to it?
Fresh bruising.
Okay.
Fresh bruising tends to be the one I see the most of. And again, it's all about the techniques, and it's all about the subtlety of the hand of when you're applying the makeup. You know, using that, like I said, that makeup brush to create that very fresh, you know, brighter red color with just a little bit of that light blue as you start out. You know, and then of course those bruises advance, and then you have to consider, well, is this in the elderly? Is this in an immunocompromised patient? Because again, you have to think about every one of those scenarios as you build your story, and it's pretty amazing. I'll talk to someone about their scenario, and they're very surprised at the sort of in-depth questions I will ask them. Tell me about my patient. How old are they? How long ago did this scenario happen? And again, it has to do with, because I want to ensure that we're creating the most realistic scenario possible. So fresh bruising tends to be the one that I see mostly in our victims. The secondary thing I often see is the sort of victims that won't survive. You know, I see a lot of simulation scenarios where, you know, someone will spend a lot of time, you know, moulaging a victim, which might be beautifully done, perfect, exactly as it would look in real life, but someone's going to come along and black tag that victim, you know, within 30 seconds.
Yeah, so why put all that time and resources into that moulage for there's no real treatment? It's
correct.
A short scenario.
Correct. And so, you know, what we like to design are scenarios that are authentic, that are cost-effective, that are truly time-effective, because if it's taking you longer than a few minutes per victim to moulage them, beautifully, mind you, I'm not talking cheap moulage, I'm not talking techniques that aren't authentic, then you're actually spending too much time on your victims. I can personally moulage 60 victims on my own within 2 hours. Mm. Now, it is not a pleasant 2 hours.
Right.
But I can do it.
Yeah. And
I do that primarily because most of my wounds are pre-made coming in.
Okay.
And I don't mean I buy them, I mean I pre-make them so that I know what my scenarios are. What my ruptured blisters look like, they're already created. What my third and fourth degree burns are, they're already done.
Yeah. So it sounds like you use this sort of train other trainers, or you train people to make their own wounds. What's a workshop look like? Is it an hour, half a day, a full day? Or what are some of the key things that happen?
Generally, it's an 8-hour day. We will customize any course as well as any kit for an individual's specific needs, but primarily, I'm brought in for an 8-hour course that takes somebody from zero or very little moulage experience to what would be considered advanced moulage experience by the end of that 8-hour day. And it's I've had several people say, you know, we could stretch this up probably into a good 2 or 3 day course. And we could. But I feel like we give people the opportunity to learn the shortcuts coming in, and we always send them out with PowerPoints also so that we ensure their success. And we do have a 100% success rate, but a lot of people don't have the sort of money and resources to spend putting a lot of people through their moulage. You know, so I always try to figure out what's best for the state, what's best for the entity coming in, and the course runs $350 per person for that 8-hour day.
Okay.
And we can connect it to CEs.
Yeah.
That's quite inexpensive.
It is very inexpensive. Again, it's really very important to me that people moulage. And so I try to create a program. And now, of course, if I have to go out of the country, which I have done, and we have to ship in all of our materials, it's a little bit more, but it's not substantially more generally. It's just the difference in the cost of shipping in our material. And we have an extensive setup. If you come to one of my courses, you will sit down to what almost looks like a formal place setting in front of you that has over 50 different products in front of you, and that's per person.
So,
including high-quality glycerin.
Yeah.
But if I could sneak in there for a second, a question I have for you is, you had touched on about mannequins. What is your, you know, we talked about common problems with making someone pale or giving them diaphoresis or the bruising thing that you talk about, but how do you protect your mannequins that you want to moulage? Is there an effective way to prevent them from getting overstained?
Yes, we do actually have simulator-specific makeup that's been designed to wash right off. Just as a segue, all of my kits are they're customized. So if you were to call and order a kit and you told me specifically, I want to change out this makeup to make specifically simulator safe, people have that option coming in. So I kind of do sort of a boutique selling idea so that people really get their needs met. They don't have to buy products they're not going to use. So with simulator safe products, we know usually that coming in. If you are coming to one of my courses, I have specific handouts on how to change out the makeup to what it is specifically you're using it for. And then there's sometimes that we just teach people about barriers. There's barriers that are called hard barriers and soft barriers. A soft barrier would be something that you could easily put your finger through. It'd be something like Vaseline or baby oil, something that would provide what's called a soft barrier so something could sit on top of it and it wouldn't permeate the skin. And then we have what's called hard barriers. That would be something more like a moulage gel or a wax paper. So we always want to maintain the integrity of our simulators moving forward every single time. This is only groundbreaking if it comes back off.
So our audience is teaching adults, you know, EMTs and paramedic students, and you're teaching adults in these workshops. What are some of your things that have worked well for you, or tips, you know, because this is a very hands-on thing, I would imagine. What makes for an effective adult education experience? Is some things that have worked for you?
Generally, you know, especially at that mass casualty training scene, I like to share my tips and tricks in my seminars, primarily because anyone leaving my course, I want to have success. Because if they have success, they're more likely to share it with their friends. I was very successful in her class. I don't want to keep anything a secret. I know a lot of Milage people, you know, want to keep those kind of skills secret so that they're really the very best in the industry. Not me. I just like to give it all away and let me show you how to be successful as you move forward. But I find that when I'm doing training scenarios, especially in a mass casualty situation, I break up my wounds. I don't ever allow somebody to do one whole wound, and that's primarily because they will love it to death. You can't get them to get their hands off of it. So what I do is, you're my blood person, you're my first layer of my burn, you're my cert person, you're my barrier person, because if I allowed someone to give me a fourth degree burn, it would take them 45 minutes, because they just couldn't stop playing with it. You know, they would want it to be perfect for the scenario. But if you only have one piece of the process moving forward, you know what I mean?
I guess it really draws out the artists in people, and they feel a sense of ownership.
Yes, and it's really sad, too, because we apparently don't have enough play in our life. Right. You can see people really begin to lighten up when they join my course. You know, everyone's very formal in the first hour. You know, we end up with a lot of military officials who come through the class, a lot of high-ranking officers. And it's the first hour is all about it's very straightforward. There's not a lot of fun. Within the second hour, you can hear people starting to laugh and giggle. You know, by the fourth hour, we're sharing jokes, we're talking, you know, we're moving forward. And people can't create wounds, and they can't really be, move forward on that creative process until they begin to lighten up.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's, and your idea of, you know, assigning different aspects to the wound, it's sort of it's the pit crew concept applied to wounds, in moulage, and you each have a specific role to play. Because I've seen far too many scenarios and simulation experiences where the time available to run the simulation is rapidly decreasing because the moulage is taking so much time, and you end up sacrificing learning and experiential time because of all the fiddling around with the moulage.
Well, I show people how, when they come into my classes, how to pre-make their wounds so that when you actually show up on a scenario, it's 5-minute application and then you're done. And I mean, and these are blisters that are going to rupture if they're handled aggressively, because that's, of course, a training set that we want to find out whether people know or not. These are wounds that can be sutured. These are wounds that they've made themselves. And so when you get there, really, it's about just application. And again, I don't even allow one whole person to applique every single wound. It's like, okay, you're my glue person. You are my, you know, ensure my seams go down person. You are my smooth out additional waxes so it molds into the skin without any lines. Now you're my blood person. Again, like I said, I break all that out so nobody gets to own one whole entire series.
Wow.
That's incredibly impressive that you're able to replicate wounds that you can get through. What kind of material do you use that will hold its integrity?
You know, I use a combination of some new materials that we have been growing, and one of them is called Silifex material, and it's quite impressive. You can do impaled objects, and it comes in variation of skin tones as well as in translucent, and that's kind of been one of my newest tools, and it's very three-dimensional. You can cut it, you can suture it, and then we add a binding material in between it so that we can cut it, we can fill it using, you know, our blood product underneath it, and then somebody could come along and suture it. And, of course, you're going to want to apply something as a stiff barrier underneath it, because you sure wouldn't want somebody to suture that wound and actually hit somebody's real skin. But you can suture them all right there.
Wow. Incredible.
Hey, Bill and Rob, we've gotten to the point where we got the time for one last question or comments. And then a closing thought on the topic from Bobby, and then we'll move into our wrap-up. So, Rob, do you have a final question or comment for Bobby?
Yeah, I want to know the link to your website and where people can get a copy of your book.
Oh, thank you for asking. My website's at www.moulageconcepts.com, and we sell my book through my website, in addition to a variation of kits. And like I had shared before, we want to customize the experience, and we do so at no extra charge. So what you can do is, if you see a kit and you know that you are going to be doing decon types of drills, or you're working primarily with simulators, we can change all of those things out so it's customized to whatever your experience is. It's really important to us that we build a customer base that understands that what we want to provide is really excellent service, using products that they are going to use. We don't actually want to sell you something you're not going to use. So you might as well be using the service. It's free.
And from the early description of your book, it sounds like a great coffee table type book. Put next to your cookbooks and your...
It is. You know, actually, I have one on my coffee table.
Perfect for the holidays, Rob, when you go to Boxing
you know
Day
that
or
cousin?
Something.
I like
you know that cousin you don't know what to buy for?
Yeah.
I'd like to leave my 12-year-old daughter with some haunting images. But that's okay.
Well, I will share this. You know, I don't know if you've priced blood lately, but blood runs around $100 a gallon.
Right.
And we do show you how to make blood for about $3.
Okay.
All right.
So it's almost paid for the whole book.
Fake blood, though.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Right.
We only use the fake blood.
Oxygen carrying capacity. And we'll put a link to your website and the book in the show notes that will be available at emseducast.com, and probably also make a mention on facebook.com/emseducast, where you can always connect with us. Bill, do you have a closing thought or comment?
Yeah. My one thought is what would be your advice? What's the best thing you could tell someone regarding moulage that's getting into it so they don't blow it?
So they don't blow it. Well, I always tell people to start with your very first semester scenarios, or the very easiest scenarios. One, it inoculates people into the entire moulage scenario scene as they move forward. And once you have your first semester scenarios or your first response scenarios down, then you can move on to the second semester and you can build your way through, and you're able to provide that level of training as a standard. It's really hard to throw moulage on people who've had 3 semesters or 2 semesters without ever having any moulage. That's kind of a group that you just can't grab them at that moment. But if it is your student standard coming through, they will buy into the story. You will be able to engage them more. It'll provide that realistic training that supports the decision making and the injury recognition, as well as that enhanced assessment that will change it forever moving forward. They will always expect scenarios to have that moulage aspect, and it's something that we should be providing them, really.
Another great question, Bill. Bobby, do you have the thought in addition to that that you want to share to wrap up this segment of the show?
Yes. I also write for EMS World magazine, so you can follow my monthly articles for free through my blog, and there's a blog page on my website, which I mentioned earlier, at moulageconcepts.com. So you can follow those along, and they're really great recipes that will move you forward without having to necessarily to subscribe to any of the different sites that does carry my recipes.
Well, that's great to know that you do have a monthly column in EMS World. They're good friends of the EMS Educast, and that's a great way for educators to stay tuned not only to moulage but all sorts of other great stuff that's happening in the industry.
Then you can also find out about upcoming events in your area. We travel all over the United States.
Awesome. Well,
thanks so much for being on the EMS Educast. It's a really neat thing that you're doing, and I think we've learned a lot and gotten some really great how-to mixed in there as well. And we like to wrap up the show with a recommendation or endorsement about a product, an app, an event, something that we like to share with the educators out there in the world. And I'm actually going to go first tonight. There's a company out of Ottawa, Canada, Rob, called Maxeon, M-A-X-X-E-O-N. They make flashlights. And a few years ago, they sent me the Pocket Floodlight pen light, which is just this incredible pen light. And I'll put a link to the review I did on that in the show notes. And then a couple days ago, they just sent me, what is this called? This is called the Maxeon Workstar 2030. And this comes in, it's this beam of light that has no hot or dark spots. So it's a smooth beam of light. I've never really seen anything quite like it.
Is it LED?
You know, you're sort of maxing me out on my technical knowledge. There's a couple cool features. One is it's super bright. The other is it has magnets in it, so you can stick it up against something metal, and it's got a hook on it so you can hang it. And they were kind enough to send me one that's in real tree camel, so I'll be taking that out to the deer camp this weekend. So thanks.
It's not for checking pupillary response. It's finding your way in the dark, I presume.
It is an LED light, and it is so bright, actually, that I think you could damage somebody's pupils if you held it very close to their eyes.
Yeah.
It says that the high has 270 out of the front lumens.
So if a headlight burns out, you could use the magnet and put it on the hood of your vehicle.
That's
the sounds of it.
Yeah, this is a real doozy. I'm excited to have it and appreciate them sending it to me. So do you have something to share, Rob?
I can't remember if I talked about this in our last show, but we held two cardiac arrest workshops, and I highly recommend giving this a try in your program, not yours, but the programs of our audience. And that,
right.
It's basically a CPR for healthcare provider research. But what we've done is we put it into kind of a drill sergeant format where we run our students through arrest after arrest after arrest. So they run a VF arrest 3 or 4 times, and then a VF arrest that deteriorates into a non-shockable rhythm, and then a non-shockable rhythm arrest that converts into a shockable rhythm, and then neonatal resuscitation and pediatric arrest. And instead of running scenarios where we give them limited information, they have to figure things out themselves, we basically give them all the information up front and just run them through it again and again and again so they develop muscle memory. And it's been really good because students were, you know, running arrests kind of slowly and clumsily and the first time, and then a little bit of improvement the second time, and by the fourth time, it was just completely stellar. And so we've done two of these so far, and I highly recommend taking that approach. So sort of incorporating the pit crew approach combined with just doing it over and over again and developing that muscle memory. Because as you know, cardiac arrest is not a difficult, complex call, but it's very labor intensive, and you've got to move quickly to, and I'm going to use words that Bill likes to hear, maximize time on chest, minimize time off, maximize depth and rate of compressions and those kinds of things. So highly, highly recommend it for anyone who wants to try it, and not difficult to do at all. You just have to sort of get away from that mentality of giving people little bit of information and letting them figure things out to feeding them everything and just having them do it over and over again.
I think we could add Moulage to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. And it also seems like you should be studying if that makes a difference, either on skill retention or passing competency tests down the line. Neat idea. Do you have anything we could put in the show notes or link to that gives more detailed description or an agenda or anything?
It was just one of those things we kind of brainstormed with two of our other faculty, Ian Drennan and Tyler Nipfelt. and we just kind of threw it together. It's not difficult at all. But the other thing I'll add to that, though, is that today's workshop, I used the Coach's Eye, which is an iOS app that we've talked about before, and it is fantastic. So we filmed a neonatal resuscitation, and it's beautiful because you play it back and you can pause it, you can draw on the video, you can use a spotlight to highlight things, you can record it, narrate it, you can switch it to slow motion. Just really, really powerful review tool.
Love it. How about you, Bobby? Do you have something you want to recommend or endorse to share with the audience?
Yeah, I would like to share that our EMS trauma kit just received the 2013 EMS World Innovation Award.
Wow.
Yes. So, and with the kit actually comes a free medical Moulage book. So we just want to get that word out there. And the kit's customizable, like we talked about. So if you were doing decon drills or working specifically with simulators or even just mass casualty, the kit can be customized to meet those specific outcomes. So we're pretty proud of it, and we'd like you to come check it out.
Definitely. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Bill, wrap us up. What do you want to share with the audience?
Well, what I want to share is what I've already shared with you and Rob earlier in the week, and I think that there is a couple of things that came out of the recent American Heart Association Scientific Assembly, which I think people will really be interested in. That's the one on the randomized controlled trial dealing with mechanical versus manual chest compression for out-of-the-hospital cardiac arrest, and that really centers around the Lucas. And then the other one is the randomized controlled trial on pre-hospital mild therapeutic or mild hypothermia for cardiac arrest patients. And both of those are available free right from the JAMA website, the full articles and stuff. And they will really make you think about your practice. And Rob, I certainly should add in yours that shows up in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is also a free download dealing with therapeutic hypothermia also.
Excellent.
Okay.
All right. Well, we sure appreciate everyone that's been a part of the show. Bobby, thank you so much. Congratulations on all the success you're having. And listeners, make sure you look for Bobby's website and her articles in EMS World Magazine. This is the show that we record before the Thanksgiving holiday in the United States. So I just want to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving, especially my co-hosts, Rob and Bill. I continue to be grateful for the friendship we have and the time we spend together. And listeners, especially those of you that will have to work on many of the upcoming holidays, we all are grateful for your service, for your communities, and just want to be grateful for you, because we know there's hardship to be away from friends and family on any holiday. And so we just want to let you know that we continue to appreciate what you do for your communities. So thanks, Rob and Bill and Bobby. And listeners, make sure you give us a shout at facebook.com/EMSEducast.